This lecture is titled Standing in This Place, and we acknowledge this particular place, O Te Poti, Dunedin, and Kaitahu, who are the first peoples of the area. As we prepared this lecture, all of us recalled those who have assisted and influenced us over the years, and we drew again on their wisdom. Tonight we are aware of them being with us as we present to you, and we ask for a few moments more of silence, particularly to recognise and farewell them again. Standing in this place, Aotearoa, New Zealand, to us means recognising the first peoples of the land and respecting their rights. Standing in this place means doing everything possible to ensure that the Treaty of Waitangi is honoured in both spirit and letter. This lecture is the result of a collaborative process between the four of us. Our contributions take somewhat different approaches, with themes interweaved through them. David and Gillian describe their experience in trying to be supporters of justice for Māori as individuals, educators, and as part of corporate Quaker witness. Their focus is at the social and political level. Linda describes being an ally within organisations and professions on a day-to-day basis and some of the challenges that presents. Her focus is at the level of professional and organisational change. Murray identifies some of the qualities needed to be an effective supporter of justice for Indigenous peoples and how we learn and develop those qualities through experience in a range of contexts. So my contribution is more at that personal level. These contributions have been informed by our reading of Jen Margaret's book, Working as Allies, Supporters of Indigenous Justice Reflect. And we acknowledge Jen's work, which was made possible in part by a Loxley Fellowship offered by the Quaker Peace and Service Committee. Each of us have had to trim back our contributions in order to create a lecture presentation of about an hour. Our contributions are therefore slightly different to the written version, which we encourage you to read.
Our experience as allies for Māori has been mainly in providing education for non-Māori adults in their working roles. In our 26 years of freelancing as the Rowan Partnership, the Treaty of Waitangi has become the primary focus in the education we offer. We've been based in Whanganui, but we've worked throughout the country.
We are both Quakers and married to each other. Our Quakerism has shaped our shared work and our approaches to it. In what we have to say here, we're reflecting partly on our own experience, partly on a set of experiences shared collectively with other Whanganui Quakers, and partly on the way these experiences relate to Quaker commitments made at a national level through our yearly meeting.
Many participants in our workshops come expecting Māori trainers. They're surprised that we are Pākehā. We make it clear that Te Tiriti is important to all of us and that there's a clear role for Pākehā to work with it. For Māori to work with Pākehā who are new to these matters can endanger their cultural safety. Even well-meaning comments and questions can cut to the quick when they're based on a lack of information.
So therefore, as allies, we work primarily with Pākehā to help make more sense of the past and the present and empowering them to take part in change in their environment. Our particular style involves a great deal of storytelling. We have faith in the power of the lived story told without bias. And we recall a passage from Philip Pullman's 1996 Carnegie Medal acceptance speech. All stories teach, whether the storyteller intends them to or not. They teach the world we create. They teach the morality we live by. They teach it much more effectively than moral precepts and instructions. Thou shalt not is soon forgotten, once upon a time lives forever. All of our work has resulted from our previous experiences.
For myself, those experiences were primarily in 1960s Northland, Te Tai Tokorau, where I was to be responsible for university-based adult education over the whole region. Matthew Tahau of Te Whakatohia was the Māori tutor organiser for the same area. My first visit to my future patch was made under his wing. It was a total immersion in the Māori world and its manaakitanga. This was supplemented when my first wife and I became deeply embedded in a whānau that farmed a few cows on ancestral land. The 1960s were the period of New Zealand, Aotearoa New Zealand's greatest prosperity. Talk of injustice and te tiriti was muted. So I was learning about the Māori world in a political vacuum. Subsequently, my career took me to Auckland and then to Wellington. I returned to the north in 1978 to find that the mood had altered with rising unemployment. I was aware that I must make sense of it all and try to fill the huge gap in my knowledge about how injustices to Māori had arisen. I had a sense of obligation from the way I had in earlier times been accepted and nurtured in the Māori world and from the blunt challenges that were now arising. These combined to start me on the road I now walk.
I'm a registered nurse and a teacher, but most of my work in the last 30 years has been in adult education. Most of the past 25 years have been spent on Treaty of Waitangi education in a variety of settings, including work among Quakers. Now, the catalyst for a move into such a specialised area was my appointment in 1982 as a member of a community health committee in Whangarei. This was one of several committees set up to be the interface between the community and the new area health board. The two Māori members told the rest of us that they were unwilling to be part of a Pākehā committee. They wanted a specifically Māori committee of their own. And I needed to make sense of this statement. I didn't understand it at all. So with David, I attended a workshop run by the Programme on Racism, set up by the Conference of Churches in Aotearoa, New Zealand. And I realised that my previous 24 years in Wellington had been lived in a monocultural setting. I was completely ignorant of the Indigenous history of this land and had been so for the whole time that I'd lived here. My new learning began there and has continued ever since, and has ultimately brought me here to stand in this place.
In 1991, at the invitation of Australian Quakers, we gave the annual Backhouse Lecture under the title Loving the Distances Between Racism, Culture and Spirituality. Since that time, since 1991, there have been major changes at a national level here. Some of them are: increasing awareness of the reality and potential effects of climate change and environmental degradation. A variety of settlements of historic Māori grievances against the Crown. The first faint stirrings in the non-Māori community of concern for constitutional change. The rapid development of a larger Māori professional and managerial class. The continuing erosion and casualisation of opportunities for insecure workers. The way in which the nation's limited economic gains have primarily benefited a small privileged elite, and the prospect of a Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. All of these have major implications for those who see ourselves as allies for Māori. The settlements for historic grievances in particular are giving rise to the description of the future as the post-settlement period. The process is taking place against a backdrop of widespread public ignorance and some resistance. As allies, we must constantly nurture the quality of relationships with Māori. We have to be sensitive to issues of power, We have to be alert to any hint of resistance. We have to be open to giving and receiving feedback. It's only to be expected that in the early stages of any new relationship with Māori people, there will be an understandable wariness of any Pākehā as part of the dominant culture. Even when a deeper perception has been established, there can be rapid reversion to suspicion and resistance if obstacles arise. It's so easy to get things wrong. About 15 years ago, we arranged a weekend gathering with Pākehā and Māori friends and colleagues. The purpose was to find better ways of communicating and cooperating. It all went horribly wrong. In our efforts to avoid taking control, we misjudged Māori expectations. In their view, we had called the hui. We were therefore responsible for ensuring that it ran smoothly and effectively. A great deal of repair work was needed. We were given a good dressing down by a kuia, and then over a cup of tea, we were lovingly asked how we were and how our work was going. Honesty, integrity, and trust, fundamental to all relationships, along with being willing to learn from mistakes and not be discouraged by them.
At a national level, Quakers had already made several collective statements and commitments. In 1995, we were ready to go further. We also recognised the extreme frustration experienced by Māori tribes and people, especially those of the younger generation, at the lack of real progress towards redressing historical grievances. This has led some of them to assert dramatically, by their physical presence on disputed land, their claim to the rangatiratanga, uncontested authority, guaranteed by the treaty, which their ancestors signed. We acknowledge that this guarantee has not yet been honoured in more than 150 years. This paragraph arose from the direct experience of Whanganui Quakers who decided to turn national statements into local action. In 1995, Te Ati Haunui a Paparangi, the iwi of the Whanganui River, occupied a small public park in the centre of the city for 79 days. This park is known as Pākaitore or Motua Gardens. Pākaitore was the traditional refuge and gathering place for the iwi, and the park contains several monuments of great historic significance. The reclamation transformed the park into a living marae. It was an expression of the grievances and the sense of identity of the iwi, and it made national and international news. It ended with a peaceful hīkoi away from the site and across the river, and so avoided forceful eviction by the police and the risk of violence. Balance lost his head fairly early on in the police, and it was replaced by a pumpkin. Eventually, all of him went.
In the early days of the occupation or reclamation, members of the Whanganui Quaker worship group went in a body to Pākaitore to show their support and were formally welcomed. Probably no one realised at the time what that visit would mean or how important it was that Quakers were expressing collective rather than purely individual support, standing in solidarity in our home place. That initial group commitment provided an opening for Quakers to discover many and varied ways to act individually as allies. Also as a group, local Quakers became part of citizen initiatives, encouraging the district council to exercise restraint and continue negotiations with the iwi.
Here's the late Chas Poynter and Niko Tangaroa, both of whom have passed on.
Later, when it seemed that police were likely to move in and evict the occupiers, other Quakers used their local networks to summon others to form a human barrier around the grounds, so that police would have to break through that thin cordon in order to reach the occupiers. That event has assumed a place in Māori consciousness in some quarters. Quakers were certainly not in the majority in the human cordon. There weren't enough of us. But their action has given friends increased credibility as a group. It's enabled Quakers to visit the Maori world without too many barriers. Perhaps in a small way, this is like the reputation of friends that resulted from famine relief work in Germany after World War I, or in Ireland during the famine, when Quakers gave food without requiring conversion to their beliefs, as other churches did.
It wasn't hard for friends to support the Whanganui reclamation or occupation, given the commitment of the Maori leaders to non-violence and their conduct of the event in the spirit of Parihaka, the Taranaki village where the 1870s two prophetic figures led a non-violent Maori resistance to government confiscation of their land. A number of Whanganui friends were continuously involved during those 79 days and afterwards. The two of us, for example, found ourselves taking part in a silent vigil in the city centre, giving three public talks for the race relations conciliator, joining the cordon around Pākaitore, and being present on the grounds as often as possible to signal support and many other actions. Some other Quakers were able to do more than we were able to.
Two special memories stand out. The morning after each of our public talks, we would go down to Pākaitore and mull it over with a group of the aunties who had sat in the front row for the talk. That was a necessary anchor for us. And on the morning of the final departure from the site, a kaumātua was working with the rangatahi, the young people, who had not left with the main group. We checked with him what he needed, and as a result, we called the police commander, who ordered his officers to keep the public out until the rangatahi were ready to go. That period of intense activity created or strengthened relationships which have lasted through the years since. Later, Quakers were centrally involved in arranging public talks by mainly Maori speakers. These included a series entitled Getting On, Moving On. The year 2015 will mark the 20th anniversary of the occupation or reclamation. We are currently involved with iwi representatives and others in the Pākaitore Oral History Project, creating an audio archive of interviews with people who were involved on whatever side they were. They're with people with widely varied experiences and perspectives.
To turn to current events of concern to Pākehā allies in our district, the long-standing Whanganui River claim has now been settled with the Crown, and we were fortunate to be at Rānana Marae when that agreement was signed. It was a wonderful occasion. The key feature of this settlement is that the entire river, Te Awa Tupua, an integrated living whole from the mountains to the sea, will belong neither to the Crown nor to the iwi. Instead, Te Awa Tupua will become its own legal entity, with two agents to act on its behalf to protect the health, well-being, culture and values of the river. They will develop a statement of the values which will guide all decisions affecting the river and a legally enforceable whole-of-river strategy in consultation with affected parties.
We have great hopes for this because otherwise we might find ourselves in the position of the cartoon here.
This settlement could also be a local precedent for a major addition to our national constitution. In discussing constitutional changes for Aotearoa New Zealand, friends have shown interest in recent changes to the constitutions of Ecuador and Bolivia. These nations have recognised the entity Pachamama as an independent stakeholder in their constitutional affairs. Pachamama is the Latin American name for Mother Earth or Papa Tuanuku as we know her. Aotearoa New Zealand may be a long way yet from making such a change in its constitution, but the Whanganui settlement could show the way at a local level towards development of a similar concept. That is why this settlement has attracted international as well as national interest. Quakers, along with Peace Movement Aotearoa and other treaty workers, have been promoting community discussions about constitutional change. That is, the Pachamama example has been raised as part of those discussions.
Ngāpuhi from the far north have introduced a further dimension to constitutional discussions in the first part of their claim to the Waitangi Tribunal. They have directly challenged the conventional understanding that the Treaty of Waitangi ceded Māori sovereignty to the Crown. The Waitangi Tribunal report on that is expected during this month, during October. In a parallel process, however, the Kuia and Komato of Ngāpuhi commissioned an independent report on it to stand alongside the Tribunal's findings. The result, titled Ngāpuhi Speaks, was prepared by an invited panel of two Māori and two Pākehā writers, and contributions were made by other Pākehā, including myself. In the post-settlement environment, the financial component of the settlements offers a way for iwi to return to the economic mainstream after a long exile from it. I hardly need to say that in this area, which is Naitahu and which has been such a success story. On a per capita basis, the settlements are very limited indeed. But as capital concentrated into the hands of each iwi holding body, they're a significant source of new or expanded ventures within the Māori economy. Future experience will be varied. Some iwi will achieve great success, others may fail. Members of the expanding Māori professional and managerial class face temptations as well as opportunities. Some will serve their people and the wider community, others may serve themselves. It has never been possible to make a statement about Māori which is true for all of them. Generalisations will be even less appropriate in the post-settlement era. What does all this mean for Pākehā allies? The very terms ally and alliance need some thought. For some, the words are associated with military contexts. For others, they may invoke a sense of being subordinate, compromising one's own values. Neither of those interpretations is justified by history or usage. The shorter Oxford English Dictionary gives us main meanings for alliance, combination for a common object, and people united by kinship or friendship. Those sound right to us. We live within a system, partly inherited, partly created over the past 30 years, that gives major benefits to an elite 10%. They are the people whose incomes have been increasing in real terms and whose interests determine the direction of the country.
Tim Howard, who is one of the people in interviewed in Jen Margaret's book, notes that, quote, our natural tendency might be to work with the existing system, a deeply colonial system that doesn't benefit Indigenous people. Alternatively, we can align ourselves with those who are disenfranchised and whose opportunities and incomes have remained static or actually decreased. Many of them are young Indigenous people, but there are plenty of others whose situation is similar. Being an ally does not imply subservience. We need not accept everything that our partners do or want. Tim Howard comments, there is a challenge to us not to go into the relationship as passive, unthinking servants, but to go in with some strength, some spine. We're more used to Māori if we're coming in with all of our skills, all of our strength, and particularly all our integrity.
We all need to work on the basic assumption that the ideas and proposals and actions put forward through representative Māori voices will be worth exploration, whether or not we finally agree. This, as we see it, is hoa tautoko, the supportive stance of a friend or of a capital F friend. In the words of Michael Lunig's Prayer for Friends, we give thanks for our friends, our dear friends. We anger each other, we fail each other. We share this sad earth, this tender life, this precious time. Such richness, such wildness. Together we are blown about, together we are dragged along, all this delight, all this suffering, all this forgiving life, we hold it together.
The same opportunities to achieve as others. I'm offering my current understandings, acknowledging that these can and may change over time. One of my favourite sayings is this from Kierkegaard, and I note that it was written in the same year that the Colonial Office said that the treaty applied even to those who had not signed it. I came to understand treaty issues from being a woman growing up in New Zealand in the 60s and 70s, and therefore my feminism, from my work in Hong Kong and some other life experiences that gave me insight and experience of being seen as other. These and my Quaker understandings of that of God in everyone provided a framework for my understanding of the documented inequities for Māori in health, education, and justice when I finally saw them. I worked at Otago Polytechnic for nearly 25 years, during which time there have been major changes, and particularly since the Ngāi settlement. Ngāi first complained about breaches of the treaty in 1849, and these were finally settled in 1998. Post-settlement, there have been substantial initiatives by Ngāi to work together with Crown agencies, and I have merely been part of these in my diverse leadership and staff roles. Otago Polytechnic signed a formal memorandum of understanding with the Whorunaka of this area and set up an ongoing committee which I was on. The committee Kawanataka had responsibility for monitoring and reporting on activities following the signing of the MOU, and it was designed to embed, or if you wanted to use some other words, infiltrate and normalise new ways of doing things into Otago Polytechnic. And this committee started by developing a Māori strategic framework. And now, in every area of the Polytechnic, there are actions and expectations built into the annual plan, which are externally audited and reported to annual review meetings with the local Runaka. If the Treaty of Waitangi had had an established review mechanism, iwi might not have had to wait until 1975 to have a way of addressing unmet commitments. Within the Polytechnic, there are six priority areas. And there are dual-run treaty workshops run by one Māori and one Pākehā facilitator, which I've been involved with over a number of years. And these not only look at some of the differences in interpretation, but also explore what is expected of people within departmental plans and the support and expectations of individual staff and student activities. We still have less than 10% of staff who identify as iwi, a lower qualification completion rate for Māori than for non-Māori students, although it is getting closer. And from these diverse activities, I've come to understand Pākehā colleagues and student reactions to treaty issues through Linda Jeff's notion. Challenge is important for change, Otherwise, we just stay within our comfort zones. But fear and defensiveness is a barrier to change. So allies need to explain, reassure, interpret, and challenge their colleagues. And I'm going to share a couple of stories about this. Occupational therapy students visit the marae, where they both do a treaty workshop, and where they first do their mihi mihi in public. In one visit, I was extremely perturbed by the tawa shouting out across the meeting house to a student who was sitting on her pillow. Now, I grew up in a very good Presbyterian family, where if somebody was behaving in ways that you didn't think were appropriate, you quietly took them to one side and provided feedback so that they wouldn't be embarrassed in public. And I mithered for some days and weeks and years about what I would say to her, about not embarrassing the students. And I came to recognise that I was a wimp for saying nothing to her. A colleague of mine saw my ambivalence and my distress and reminded me that in different places, different things are done differently. And it was several years later that I finally got it, that one individual may feel embarrassed, but everybody else would learn very quickly. And 60 other students would not have to breach the mana of the house 60 times. And I finally saw my tendency to give status to an individual rather than to the community. And I came to understand something that I think of as the difference between conditional respect and true respect, which occurs whether or not I understand. I've learnt to give away my need to understand something before I act, approve, or respect how somebody else does things. My colleague, in reminding me that different things were done differently in different places, was being an ally both to me and to Māori. And now we tell students this story in advance so that they know that things may be done differently in different places. My second small example is that of Justine Kemp, my kaitahu office mate, who got extremely irritated and sick of telling people what to do and where to go. And we ended up capturing that into a staff advisory policy document, which has become a composite work that converted irritation to action. Some of my learning from these years of workshops and committees and marae visits is that there are difficult Māori, ones that I just don't warm to, those who are busy and overloaded, and those who are a delight to work with. Just like my colleagues in my own work areas and my Quaker colleagues in monthly meeting or yearly meeting. And I've learnt that difficult people help me learn about myself, because I have learned to live with others and therefore with myself. And Anne Wade, a Quaker, describes this as getting back a missing piece of the jigsaw puzzle of myself and coming therefore a bit closer to being whole. My involvements with occupational therapy have provided opportunities for what Jen Margaret describes as sustained relationships. In the early 1980s, I worked with, and she says was helpful to, a student who was having some difficulties on a fieldwork placement. At the time, I didn't know that she identified as Māori. She has since told me that that was because she was not public about that at the time. We are now both much older and have more significant roles within the profession. And Jane Hopkirk and I have run workshops together and written together. And she has given me a quilt, separate pieces joined together irrevocably into now a single whole. So the most recent thing that Jane and I have been involved with, not only on our own but with others, both Māori and Pākehā, has been working on a review of the competencies for registration and ongoing approval to practice for the occupational therapy profession. And I need to say, for those of you who are not part of registerable health professions, professional competencies are big deals. We are putting titiriti into the expectation of all occupational therapists. We expect and are being challenged about this, but we are creating an expectation that all professionals will understand how their practice actions with an individual link to health outcomes for whole communities. And it's our trust built in working together on smaller projects that has let us tackle and cope with these fairly big projects. And from that, I have come to understand that there are things that Pākehā can offer, whatever our work or daily life is. And I'm going to describe these as two related but different ideas that my occupational therapy colleagues will be familiar with. We can use both the just right challenge and the teachable moment to support and challenge Pākehā who tend or may see in a given specific situation the individual advantage rather than the substantial systemic injustices and inequities. Pākehā can both challenge and seize teachable moments. Because there are key ways in which Pākehā who have come to understand individual and systemic advantage and disadvantage can be allies according to what our particular roles and skills and occupations are. Being an ally requires us to get it right, to be active and do enough, but not too much. We need to be wary of our own status. My experiences of being other does not give me authority to speak for others. Iwi might keep asking more of us because we have just about got it right enough. They too use the notion of the just right challenge to keep extending us to support them. We need to keep acting in ways that address oppression, racism, stereotyping, injustices and inequities so that iwi have the same opportunities to live life as they choose, to participate actively as citizens of the world and to enjoy good health and a high standard of living, which is just what we want for ourselves and our own families.
To me, standing in this place means knowing this place, Aotearoa, and its peoples and its history. Standing in this place also means knowing who I am who stands. A key aspect of this is captured by one of my favourite pieces of Pākehā wisdom from the teachings of Jesus, love thy neighbour as thyself. It reminds us that the more self-aware we are and at peace and confident within ourselves, the better able we are to connect with the other. This is particularly critical for Pākehā who work for justice for Indigenous peoples, because it is by definition cross-cultural work in which there are traps for those less self-aware. It is not uncommon for Pākehā to go overboard and desire to become Māori, as Michael King describes it, when they experience the richness and vitality of Māori culture and see the ways in which it is threatened by the ongoing process of colonisation. Feelings of guilt and loss of identity, however, do not form a sound base from which to support justice. And King is highly critical of such motivations. And I quote, "I feel nothing but sadness for Pākehā who want to be Māori, or who believe they have become Māori, usually empty vessels waiting to be filled by the nearest exotic cultural foundation, who romanticise Māori life and want to bask forever in an aura of aroha and āwhina." He's pretty tough. These are the same people who crumple with disbelief and shock the first time somebody calls them honky or displays some other of the more robust characteristics of Māori behaviour. There was much in my background that provided a strong foundation of identity, and one would think that this would prevent a loss of perspective. However, I can now recognise ways in which I did not meet the challenge adequately for some time. My parents provided a family and community environment with a clear set of values and strong appreciation of Western literature and music. Like other children in the Short family, I studied music during my school and university years, and I played in orchestras and bands, played the flute, until the demands of a career took priority. Our active involvement in the Quaker community provided a framework of values with particular emphasis on peace and egalitarianism. We developed political awareness from an early age and were active participants in peace and anti-racist movements during the Vietnam War and the South African rugby tour period. My upbringing fostered clarity and strength of identity. However, awareness of Māori came relatively late in life. It's a familiar theme. I had progressed through an education system that largely ignored pre-colonial history and the process of colonial oppression which followed the arrival of European settlers in the 19th century. This meant that I lacked knowledge of Māori as peoples, their history, language and culture, and about the politics of Indigenous justice. My first real experience was when, as a 23-year-old, I started work in the Department of Māori and Island Affairs in Rotorua, and John Rangiho, the district welfare officer, introduced me to the local Tūhoe Marae Mātātua. Now, this isn't Mātātua, this is actually the Marae in Maunga Pohatu, which still stands, Rua Kinana's Marae. And some of you will recognise some of the figures in here, no doubt. I pushed the wrong button. Duncan McIntyre, very well-respected Minister of Māori Affairs, Scottish, and Māori warmed to him in part because there seemed to be an understanding from the Scottish background of some of what was happening to Māori. Jock McEwen, who was Secretary of Māori Affairs at that time, a very talented carver, very well-respected in the Māori world as well, fluent speaker of Māori. There's a somewhat hirsute Murray Short back in, this is 1972. I've lost a bit. And a really great lineup of tūhoe kaumātua from Maunga Pohatu, from Ruatahuna, from Ruatoki, from Waimana, all of the valleys and the major areas in tūhoe. Participation in mātātua activities was a wonderful experience. And it made a major impact on me. Just bear in mind, coming to this with a strong Pākehā identity. I well remember the tingling sensation down my spine when taking part in the haka group, that physical response to the beauty of the music. I was fortunate to be able to compare it with responses to music in a totally different cultural environment when playing the flute. That kept me grounded. With other experiences, I responded differently. With the tangi, for example, I was hugely impressed not only with what seemed to me a healthier way of managing the grieving process, but also with the commitment to community life that tangi represented. Tangi are significant exercises in logistics, with hundreds, sometimes thousands of guests visiting during the three-day event. The people of the marae work long hours to make their visitors welcome by providing food and accommodation. Demands on the time and energy of individual members often conflict with the demands of their paid employment. And I observed that several members of the mātātua community lost their jobs because of these competing obligations. In my role as a Māori welfare officer, I was required to find employment opportunities for young Māori and to provide assistance and advice as they settled into their jobs. On occasions, I was required to assist when problems arose with demands of the marae on their employment time. I found myself critical of the employers, mostly Pākehā, because they failed to recognise the importance and value of marae work. This attitude did not recognise the dilemma that the employers faced in their need to meet deadlines and provide service to customers in a competitive environment. It revealed a loss of sense of who and what I was. I was so impressed with the Māori world that the foundation of my identity and awareness was compromised. Not only were interventions based on this attitude likely to alienate employers, but my ability to obtain job placements was threatened. I would have been much more effective if I had made a greater effort to understand the employer's perspective as well as that of the employee. This would have encouraged understanding and assisted in the finding of solutions that respected both sides. There were bigger lessons for me in my work as a Māori welfare officer, which led me to wonder whether my work was in fact supporting justice for Māori and whether it was appropriate for me to be in such a position at all. A speech by John Rangihau at a Māori Welfare Officers Association conference in 1972, here's John, in 1970. So a speech by him in 1972 was the turning point for me. In challenging officers about their part in promoting the assimilation policies of government, he used the imagery of the bellwether sheep leading the flock to slaughter. He pointed out that whilst the welfare officer worked to settle Māori people into new homes and jobs, improve their success in a Western education system, Māori culture and language were dying. Until the 1970s, the work of the Māori officer was an integral part of government policy designed to assimilate Māori into a single culture society based on Western European traditions and practices. A significant gap existed between Māori and the rest of the population in terms of education, employment, health, and other social outcomes in that single culture society. Still true, I'm afraid. Most of our effort was directed at measures designed to close the gap. Because I was politically unaware of Indigenous issues when I accepted the position, I did not question this at all at first. I'm sure I would have asked if I would have said at the time that the best way to support justice for Māori was to help close those economic and social gaps. I did not recognise the risk that the policy may also require Māori to become more like us. The association accepted John's challenge and became an effective pressure group. Partly due to its efforts, the purpose and objectives of the Māori Welfare Division and the wider department changed dramatically during the 1970s and 80s. Most employment, housing and welfare work was mainstreamed, leaving the department to concentrate on Māori cultural development through programs such as Tūtangata, Kōhanga Reo and Mātua Whāngai. It was exciting to be part of this process, and the new direction led me to a deeper examination of my role. By 1973, I saw that it was no longer appropriate for me as a Pākehā to stay in the Māori welfare field. I resigned and took up a position in the Department of Justice as a probation officer. In 1975, I also completed an MA in social work at Victoria University. That study reinforced learnings from the period of change at the Department of Māori and Island Affairs and expanded my understanding of the role of supporter of justice for Indigenous peoples. Social workers are well aware that their interventions, whilst relieving individual disadvantage or disconnection, fail to affect the social, economic, and political policies that are the root cause of individual problems. The interventions in isolation tend to contribute to the maintenance of social control and the status quo. Peter Day, in his book Social Work and Social Control, explores the ethics of this and concludes that the dilemma places special obligations on social workers. The consensus view, he says, and this is a quote from Peter Day, sees social work as a benevolent method of social control, and this is one of its functions. Its other functions, which can complement the control functions, include the general aims of relieving social distress and offering material aid and counselling to individuals and families. But another general aim is social reform through pressure on government to implement change or social welfare policy. In arguing for this view, it is essential that social workers continually re-examine their position in relation to the norms or rules governing social life which they are supposed to support. The lesson in this, for me, is that good intentions are not good enough. One needs to maintain constant awareness of the wider context within which one acts. This is as relevant for supporters of justice for Indigenous peoples as for social workers. A good ally needs this wider awareness in order to avoid the risk of exacerbating the very issues that are being addressed and the risk of becoming or contributing to the bellwether sheep. Supporting Indigenous justice from within the establishment is rarely easy, as it generates tensions and conflicts that are difficult to manage. As that saying would have it, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. And one frequently faces the choice of continuing to work from within or choosing to leave and work in a different context. When I took up a position in Wellington as a senior manager in the Department of Justice in 1986, I was struck by the contrast presented by a prison and probation system that had a high proportion of Māori clients and yet predominantly non-Māori staff. Values, processes and structures were totally Western, and there was no mechanism for bringing Māori views into the decision-making process. It was difficult to know how best to support justice for Indigenous peoples in this context. At times, I questioned whether it was possible, and I considered moving out of the environment entirely. However, in the Rotorua probation office, and later as a manager of the Taupo office, I worked closely with a number of Māori staff. Concerns about the lack of a Māori dimension in the department led us to form an organisation which we initially called the Cultural Advisory Group. Our aim was to push for change, and the opportunity to contribute to this group was a major factor in my decision to stay and work from within the department. From my learnings about the importance of the wider context, I could see that any change we might bring about would still be largely about assimilation, because the aim was to encourage greater participation by Māori in a Western institution. In discussions within the group, we developed the view that this was a necessary stage in the process of development. The concept of a parallel system based on Māori values and processes would have been, and still would be, more effective. When this was proposed by Moanda Jackson in a research project report in 1988, called The Māori and the Criminal Justice System, A New Perspective, He Whaipaunga Ho, the Secretary for Justice wrote, "Undoubtedly the most controversial part of the report is its advocacy of an autonomous system for dealing with Māori offences. that parallels the existing criminal justice system. This proposal is rested on the status of Māori as tangata whenua and on an interpretation of the word rangatiratanga in the Treaty of Waitangi. It is not clear from the report what this parallel system might entail in practical terms, but it is a concept that has already raised concern in the wider community, and it is one which the Minister of Justice has specifically rejected. The Minister has made it clear that while he supports the need to make the legal system sensitive to Māori values and needs, he believes it is essential that New Zealand retains one legal system in which everyone is equal under the law. This position is still held by government, and there is little sign of willingness to consider significant change. The Cultural Advisory Group concluded that it was most important to ensure that Māori perspectives were included in decision-making processes. The current minimal Māori participation at senior levels needed to be addressed through changes in recruitment, promotion, and equal opportunity procedures. Because such change would take a considerable amount of time, our first push was to have a Māori advisory group established that would have direct access to senior management of the department. We knew that this was an inadequate response to a deep and pervasive problem, but it was seen to be a necessary first step in ensuring that Māori perspectives were included in the decisions about more substantial change in the department. Rome wasn't built in a day. In the post-settlement period, the supporter of justice for Māori will be as useful as ever, in my view, and a key role will be to find every means possible to counter the misinformation that is currently abroad. Indigenous justice is an area where the public seem very susceptible to influence by such misinformation. I sense the existence of a growing non-Māori perception that once the settlement process is complete, Māori should look after their own social and economic outcomes. Well, as they say, if you believe that, I've got a bridge to sell you. This perception is revealed in frequent criticisms that the settlement monies to date are not benefiting the majority of Māori. Two common themes come through, that the monies aren't being distributed to the people generally, and that there's a corporate elite developing. Very interesting criticisms. We seem to use double standards very much. But given the size of the settlement monies, a tiny fraction of the damage that was done, and a drop in the bucket when you think of the numbers in these tribal groups. But more than that, iwi and hapu are developing their own economic and financial models that will ultimately deliver benefits widely among their members, and this will take time. And anyway, as long as Māori continue to pay taxes to government, they should also expect the same levels of service as everyone else. As they move towards greater independence, they may wish to deliver services in their own way, but funding for these services should be available in the same way as it is for any other taxpayers. The move towards greater independence will accelerate. The post-settlement period is likely to see growing pressure for self-determination. Possible options range from devolution of certain government services, as proposed, for example, in the recent deed of settlement with Tūhoe, what's now a Tūhoe Act, to extensive regional autonomy along the lines of the Scottish Parliament model. I was fascinated, incidentally, in the debates over the Home Rule for Scotland, that the Orkney Islands actually have an arrangement with central government, and they're going to move toward that more in Scotland now, where the taxes that are raised on the island are spent by the islanders in the way they choose. Now, that's the sort of continuum that we need to be thinking about in New Zealand. So, from that Scottish model, Orkney model, through to some early attempts that we see in the deed of settlement with Tūhoe. Indications from submissions to the recent Constitutional Review Panel suggest that many citizens feel very threatened by these possibilities. There was a flood of anti-treaty submissions to the Constitutional Advisory Panel and people pushing this one law for all, which is a very curious notion, given that Aucklanders have a different set of laws than Dunedinites, I think, and many, many other examples. But these common perceptions and fears need to be discussed openly, and those who wish to continue to support justice for Māori will have an important role in the facilitation of debate. Jen Margaret notes that trust is important for strong relationships, and the whole question of how we know what Indigenous people think of our work is one of the challenges for allies. I've been fortunate to be part of processes where this has been revealed, largely through continuing relationships and dialogue. In ending, I wish to acknowledge how fortunate I have been to have my connection with Tūhoe through my wife Niwa and her family. The Tūhoe connection has given me a mutually understood and trusted place in most Māori contexts. I'm usually referred to as the hunaunga, the son-in-law, and treated as part of the Tūhoe extended family. Through this relationship and those with Māori colleagues, I have gained some insight into the issues that concern Māori and their attitude to these issues. Inclusion in informal and formal discussions and debates in the Māori context continues to have a major influence on my thinking and being in this place. They have also left me full of admiration for the patience, forbearance, and generosity of spirit that I see every day in the attitudes and actions of the Indigenous peoples of this place.
By each doing what we can to support justice for Māori, we'll create a place here that is safe and equitable for all. By working together, we can strengthen all of our lives and all of our opportunities, and we can stand together in all of our differences. We used Jen Margaret's work to help us reflect on our experiences of diverse ways in which Quakers in Aotearoa New Zealand are working in solidarity with diverse Māori individuals and iwi to address aspects of inequity. There are challenges in being an ally to the self, to others, and to the system. We deliberately chose to do this as a group. We are two men and two women. We were born in New Zealand and overseas. We're all Anglo-Celts, but we have experiences in living and working in different parts of the globe. We reviewed each other's work and amended it on the basis of feedback, sometimes quite robust. We have different experiences that collectively, we hope, are useful for people to see how individually and collectively they can act to support tino rangatiratanga. One of the blessings and one of the curses of our ancestry is the emphasis on individualism and personal responsibility. By working communally and collaboratively, we've attempted to show how people can work in the diverse sectors in which change is needed, politically, socially, organisationally, and professionally. And in this way, we can bed in the changes that iwi are calling for, which are also the changes our Quaker testimonies to equality and integrity demand. We do this acknowledging our Quaker history and culture, and I quote from our founder George Fox that we should be patterns, be examples in all countries, places, islands and nations, wherever you come, that your carriage and life may preach among all sorts of people and to them. Then you will come to walk cheerfully over the world, answering that of God in everyone.